The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Today we're going to devote an episode to Dolores O'Riordan, who died a couple weeks ago and inspired an incredible outpouring. I think that Generation X is getting really tired of losing their icons and heroes and wants to remind the world that they slash we really cared about this music, cared about this era, cared about the stars. And David Brown, who wrote an excellent article about Dolores O'Riordan's final days, is here in the studio with me. Hey, David.
Hey, Brian.
And in a little bit, we're going to talk to Samuel Bayer, who directed the Cranberry Zombie videos, several of their other videos, as well as Smells Like Teen Spirit video and the No Rain video. So, David, what surprised you most in your reporting on Dolores O'Riordan?
Well, I think I was reminded all over again of the kind of troubled life she had from her earliest days. You know, they'd been sort of out of the spotlight for a while. The Cranberries, they put out an unplugged acoustic album last year, but for the most part, things weren't quite at the intensity level that they were 20 years ago. And so, you know, you kind of forget that she, from childhood, had some really difficult times and that they seemed to sustain. And, you know, I was also reminded again of how impacted she was by fame early on. Again, that was so long ago now. That was 25 years ago was their first album. You kind of forget that she was had all kinds of breakdowns and things very early on, and that they continued for a really long time, which helped explain the Cranberries kind of coming in and out of existence as well.
I went back and read our early interviews with the Cranberries and with the Dolores, and a few things jumped out at me. You know, this mix of a lot of confidence. She had this amazing quote that when she first auditioned for the guys in the Cranberries, she'd actually seen an ad in the newspaper that she knew they were going to be impressed. And of course they were. I mean, think about, you're just a bunch of basically schlubs, talented schlubs, and this future star with this enormous, incredibly distinctive voice steps to the microphone, and you know that your life just changed, you know. And right. She, you know, she had a voice that she said from the time she was 5 years old, people recognize. You know, she was supposed to stand on the desk in class and sing for the other children.
Right.
But as you said, also a troubled upbringing in some ways as well.
Troubled. And to go back to your point, I mean, the very original version of the Cranberries, when they were called Cranberries Saw Us, which is a terrible pun, they had a whole different singer, a male singer, who was leaving, and so she just auditioned for this, and they had music, and she brought the words. And, you know, apparently, like I said, kind of blew them all away right away. And I think that voice, you know, it's interesting to be reminded again of, she had such a kind of beguiling, kind of siren-like voice. It was so different from so many singers at the time. When you think back, there was none of that testosterone rage of a lot of the quote-unquote grunge era. And I think that she hit such a sweet spot in that the music was sort of its time, but the voice was so intimate and sort of beautiful.
They were also a great example of a band who kind of rode the alternative wave of the 90s. And if you listen to something like Linger, their first single, that was before they bought a fuzz pedal. You know, that was more in the vein of the past few years of sort of college rock. They sounded like the Sundays. They're heavily influenced by the Smiths. And one of the reasons that their first two albums sound so fantastic is they were produced by Stephen Street, the longtime Smiths producer. Right. And I mean, let's hear Linger to get a sense of Cranberries in their kind of original form. So that and Dreams, as you said, was it's all guitar shimmer and the prettier side of her voice. And
sort of like Enya in a flannel shirt.
Kind yeah,
of
for sure. Very, very pretty, though.
And one of the things I did learn in talking to the person who managed them sort of right during the heyday from like 94 to 2000 or so was, you know, Zombie was a very calculated, I don't mean that in a bad way, but move on Dolores' part. You know, she wanted to be, according to him, the biggest star or a huge international star. And she knew that the band had to not just write love songs and appeal to women. They want. She thought they had to have male and female fans. And they noticed that. I mean, Zombie is a much more intense, musically intense song than anything they'd ever done. And I guess the record company wasn't happy about that and tried to talk her out of it. But she was determined that that was the thing. And of course, they had that great Sam Bayer video where she's painted in gold. And that did prove to be the breakthrough for them.
And she apparently wrote it without the guitarist, Noel Hogan, who had been a big part of the other songwriting and a big part of the band's sound. And it's also, she clearly was listening to what was going on in America. She was listening to Nirvana. And let's hear Zombie to get a sense of just how fast they changed. It was, you know, it was only a year later, but a lot of things were very different very quickly. We were talking before the show about this issue of the 90s and the 90s alternative explosion and the way it propelled people who ordinarily wouldn't have been big stars into the direct center of pop culture. And a lot of these people, you know, Kurt Cobain is probably the most famous example, but it's really everyone from Fiona Apple to Chris Cornell. A lot of these people, you know, might have had a degree of mental illness, might have just had the completely the wrong personalities, and it was rough on them. And I think she's an example of that, right?
She seems to be. I mean, the first Cranberries album came out when she was 21, and they hadn't been around that long. They were playing pubs and clubs in Limerick, which, you know, I've been to. It's a bustling city, but it's not New York or anything. And so they almost went from 0 to 10 very quickly, and the impact on that, you know, someone who was very emotionally fragile to begin with, you know, based on so many things that happened in her childhood. And it became apparent really quickly that, I mean, they had to, like, bail out on a tour in 96. And, she, you know, the bipolar issues started coming into effect. And the fame aspect, you know, even though part of her obviously really wanted it, like with Zombie, but it sort of came rain down on her. It seemed like a lot more, and we saw the impact on it longer. I mean, we lost Kurt much sooner, and she was dealing with it for many, many years afterwards. And we saw that, that example of that kind of damaged person who's thrust into the spotlight.
She only realized she was bipolar a couple years ago, it seemed like,
right?
Which is very late in life to be figuring that out when she'd already had so many problems. And, you know, it was rumored in our first cover, in our only cover story on the Cranberries, there's a bit where she denies this rumor of a breakdown. Now, a couple years ago, she actually talked about this breakdown. She describes it as fairly horrific. It sounds worse than bipolar. It sounds almost like a psychotic break. She talks about, she said she was hallucinating like in the movie Jacob's Ladder, which means not great. So she was, again, not suited for this. By the time she had kids, she wanted to step away. She said that she actually had a period where she was so far away from music that she wouldn't even sing in the shower, which is an intense thing. That made me kind of sad, actually.
Yeah, a lot of things sad. I mean, even though she talked later about that early breakdown and how she would just feel so lonely, like she was just yanked out of her, you know, semi-childhood, young adulthood, and thrown on the road in a bus with bands. And, you know, there weren't cell phones, you know, so you wanted to call your family. You had to, you didn't know anyone other than the couple guys in the band. You were you were thrust into the rock apparatus out in the middle of nowhere, and how kind of disorienting that all was.
Well, we should hear Ode to My Family, which was an early song she wrote that is all the more poignant when you understand this is just someone who maybe felt like she had to grow up too fast, and not only that, but be thrust into a spotlight she never prepared for. And it's one of the most, it's so emotionally naked. This is not a subtle hint in the lyrics. This is directly what the song is about. So let's hear that.
Turn away from me, 'cause I spent half my life.
This is something we experienced with Chris Cornell recently, is that, you know, all these songs sound different now when you have a different sense of how real these people's pain and issues were, you know.
And I think it explains a lot of the outpouring among, as you say, maybe that particular generation of music fan. I think people, they connected to her in a lot of ways. They could sense that damage, maybe even early on in the words that she's saying, and they related to her in a very deep kind of emotional way that wasn't necessarily always the case with, you know, maybe a Billy Corgan or something. It was a different kind of bond.
I mean, those first two albums especially, like, people carried them with them through their lives, and even if they hadn't listened to them in a few years, they kind of feel them in their bones. But the Cranberries broke up in 2003, and she recorded a couple of solo albums. They came back together in 2009 and actually sort of recaptured, as you said, their original sound with Stephen Street even. And back in 1996, their third album, they moved away from Stephen Street, tried way too hard to make like a sort of arena rock thing. There's a song called Salvation that actually was a number one modern rock hit that I'd completely forgotten about, frankly. And I think it exemplifies a band kind of losing their way in trends. It'll be good to hear that one. Let's hear it. Also, it's a pretty trite anti-drug song,
but even there, like, her voice cuts through that. I mean, she had a very recognizable voice,
right? But back to the last few years, she had an overdose on pills in 2012, had a drinking problem. Her marriage ended in 2014, and she had an incident on a plane where she was arrested. I think she stepped on the foot of a flight attendant,
resisted arrest, and headbutted the cop who was trying to do it, and ran away from the cop at first.
She said something like, you can't arrest me, I'm an icon. But this was, I think, what prompted her to get the diagnosis that she had bipolar disorder. She was probably in a manic episode, and that's really sad. And, you know, she's had a rough few years. And then what happened in the last couple years? Because she was in the studio, she had some health issues. What was going on?
Well, she moved to New York, where she had a new boyfriend who was a DJ, and they started a band with Andy Rourke of the Smiths called Dark. And so she was kind of working on that, and it was an interesting kind of different sound for her, a little more electronic. She also still had a place in Limerick, in Ireland, too, and there was gave a very intense interview to an Irish journalist over there in that year, in 2014, where she was basically saying, oh, I need help, but I can do it myself, I'm fine, that kind of thing, even though, from all intents and purposes, she looked emaciated and still had bruises on her from the airline.
Yeah, we didn't discuss that. She also discussed an eating disorder that she was grappling with. She said she experienced childhood sexual abuse. So it was just a dangerous cocktail of stuff going on with her. And then plus, you read about she had back pain from playing guitar on stage, I guess.
Yeah, another tragic thing was, you know, last year was supposed to be their kind of big comeback. You know, they put out this Unplugged record and they had a whole tour planned and dates here in the States and Europe, and the whole thing had to be canceled because she had supposedly back pain from guitar, and it was excruciating. And, you know, it seemed like one day she would be up and next day down. That's what happens. And it also seems like that's what happened maybe in her last couple of days. You know, people who talked to her the day before she died and a few days before, who I've been in touch with, all said, you know, she seemed to be in a good space. You know, the Cranberries were starting to make a new record. She had a second, she was in London partly to finish up the second Dark record. She had all these kind of projects in the works, and the next day, you know, we find out what happened, although we don't fully know, right? We won't know until April.
It's a little chilling how much of this stuff matches the pattern we've seen with musicians in the past few years. Physical pain from touring, possibly untreated mental illness. You know, it all comes together. And I don't know if there's anything to be done about all this other than, I certainly, if I were a manager working with musicians, I would be extremely aware of these sort of occupational hazards, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, gosh, you know, the whole big pharma thing is a whole other aspect to this that I'll be exploring in a future Rolling Stone story, as I can say.
Yeah, I hope
but,
so.
But since we don't have the full autopsy report with her, it's hard to tell what exactly happened.
But it seems to be leading to a certain place.
Exactly. As I say, I don't think it would surprise any of us if if this was some kind of, you know, accidental adventure, as they say.
Just before her death, she left a couple voicemail messages for a guy named Dan Waite, a label executive who had set up a collaboration for her with this band, Bad Wolves, a metal band who was doing a new version of Zombie. And I guess that never actually happened. She didn't get to sing with them. And what'd she say in those voicemails?
She apparently left a couple of, like, right after midnight, and she was supposed to go in the studio that same day. And according to Dan, who I spoke with, again, he said she sounded like in a good place. She was talking about her kids and missing them, but not in a sorrowful way. She was very psyched that Eminem had sampled Zombie on the new album,
right?
And which was a really interesting little aside there. And she even was singing a bit of the Verve hit produced by
Bittersweet Symphony.
Bittersweet Symphony produced by Youth of Killing Joke, who was also working on the second album, the Dark album, with her. So she kind of left that on the message too, as a little joke to the producer. So, you know, he didn't hear those until much later, and he said, you know, it didn't sound like she was suicidal or anything.
It's confusing.
It's very confusing.
And we have on the phone Sam Baer, who directed the Zombie video and directed many other legendary videos in his career. Sam, how you doing?
Hey, how are you?
Good. Thanks for being here.
Thrilled to be here. Well, not thrilled. I mean, it's sad, but I'm happy to talk to you.
Yeah, you've did so many great videos and many other things, including the Nightmare on Elm Street in 2010. You've had a fascinating career so far, and a lot of it included some incredibly iconic videos in the 90s, and one of them certainly was a Zombie by the Cranberries. And I wanted to sort of take you back. First, I think of many things in the video. One of them is Dolores O'Riordan in gold paint. But what do you remember about sort of your first encounter with her and the band, and how the concept for the video came together, and all that?
Well, you know, I think I was, the 90s was a great time for music, and it was an exciting time to be directing music videos for bands, and I was always on the lookout for who's the next big thing, or who am I excited about. And I think I had seen Linger, which was a black and white video. I thought she was really beautiful and everything else. And I had a friend that worked at Island Records. And I think I'd said something like, I'd love to do a video for the Cranberries. And they sent me the advance track for the second record.
Yeah.
The second record. And I heard Zombie, and, you know, I've been lucky enough to, you know, I heard the advance tracks for Nirvana. It's like, it was the same sort of thing. Like, this is amazing. This is electric. I got to do this. And, you know, but I got the gist very quickly. I think I did end up talking to her before I wrote the treatment, that this was about the problems in Ireland. It had to deal with the IRA. It had to deal with a bomb explosion and the death of a child, and it was pretty heavy. And I wrote this treatment. And, you know, I think a lot of times I tried to make music videos that were emotional. Smells Like Teen Spirit's like is a very angry video, and in many respects, Zombie's a very angry video. And I told Dolores, I want to do something that matches visually the power of your voice and the power of your lyrics. And she loved the treatment, and she was willing to be covered in gold paint, and I was willing to go to Belfast and do stuff. It was a win-win for both of us. And, you know, I when she died, it was heartbreaking. And all the guys I've worked with that are no longer here, Bowie and Cornell and Kurt and Shannon Hoon from Blind Melon, and I she was young. It was shocking. But I saw the video again, and it really kind of choked me up a little bit, just seeing this young, fragile, powerful voice, I guess, kind of extinguished forever. And that moment in time doing that video was I think it's kind of timeless.
It is. I was, you know, it's one of the 250 most watched videos on YouTube of all time, which is quite incredible when you think of how many music videos there are. And even that they're, you know, as famous as they are, they're not one of the most famous bands of all time. So that I think says a lot about that video and that song. It's incredible.
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny. I was taking a meeting yesterday about a television series, and I was telling Dolores came up in the meeting, this Hollywood meeting, and we're talking about the video. And I told these guys the story, and I'll tell it to you now, and it's kind of amazing. So I told Dolores, like, if I'm going to do this thing, I'm going to make it authentic. I'm not going to fake anything. I'm not, even if you watch a lot of music videos, they're I don't know. Music videos sometimes are an art form. A lot of times they're not that great. But I said, you know, if you're going to do something this visceral and intense and everything else, let's make this as real as possible, and I'll fly to Belfast, and I'll get images of soldiers, and I'll go to the Catholic neighborhoods, I'll go to the Protestant neighborhoods, and whatever. And I was younger and maybe kind of stupid and maybe a little brave, but I ended up going with an English film crew into Belfast and was kind of blown away by, you know, you could go to the pub and have a beer, and then you could walk on the street and have a armored Humvee walk by and track you with a 50 caliber machine gun. And, you know, it was a city under siege.
That's incredible.
And so I stood outside the a fort in whatever you call it, you know, where the British Army was, with a camera, and these steel gates opened, and this platoon came out, stopping cars and pointing guns at people, and I started filming them.
Hmm.
And it's all in the video. And I followed one soul, and I got separated from my crew, and I was in blue jeans and a T-shirt. And he's not saying a word to me, and he's got an M16 in his hand, full Kevlar, and I follow him through this neighborhood, and I get a chill up my spine. It's a very strange feeling, like just something was, I don't know, you're detached watching this stuff. Like, you don't think you're going to get shot at, or, you know, the strange empowerment that comes from holding a camera. You think that nothing's going to happen to you. And it's in the video. He crouched down.
Yeah.
We went through this place, and he crouched down. And he hadn't talked. No one had talked to me, and I really wasn't supposed to be there. And he said, he started talking to me, and he said, "What are you doing here?" And we were supposed to lie, and I was supposed to say I'm doing a documentary about peacekeeping efforts. and I don't know. I didn't lie. I said I'm doing a music video. "Oh, really? For who?" I go, "The Cranberries." He said, "Oh, Dolores, she's really pretty. I like her." then he pointed the M16 at me and said, "Get the fuck out of here."
Oh my God.
And the shot's in the video. So if you watch the video,
yeah, I just saw it. Yeah,
crouching and pointing the gun, and then just really quickly, when I walked back through that neighborhood, I found out while we were in Belfast that we were targeted by the IRA, and that they all had their eyes on me, and that there is, you know, that the British Army had come in with fake film crews, getting people on camera, and they all knew who, you know. I was just not in the greatest place. But anyways, back to Dolores. Dolores loved that. She loved that I, as an American, that I experienced something about where she's from and what was going on in Ireland at the time. And so I didn't mean to tell a big, long story, but
no, it's great.
Not much about me either. But we did the Gold Cross sequence after Belfast, and, you know, I think telling her about that stuff maybe empowered her performance.
Well, she was such a captivating screen presence. She could have been probably an actress, but she seemed totally indifferent to this aspect of her talent, and certainly was never, I don't think, ever talked about being an actress, and seemed happy to be not in the spotlight at all, which is very interesting, I think.
Yeah, and she was a star. She was beautiful to photograph. She had this amazing voice. Her vulnerability made her really special, and that's really also what broke my heart when I heard that she died. Because, you know what, I didn't, you know, I think about these people. I'm like, what happened to them? And everything. I didn't think the Cranberries were making music anymore. And you know, she was a really special person.
You work with the Cranberries on several videos, and what did you notice about her sort of dynamic with the rest of the band? What did you learn about her as a person, including the Ultima Family video?
You know, it was lead singer syndrome that I think I worked with all these bands that, I don't know, where the drummer wanted to be a star and
well, in one case, the drummer did become a star, but yes, go on.
Right. But, you know, with them, what I saw was they were almost like her brothers, that they were, the band was so enamored with their, there was kindness. They didn't fight. They were family. So even, and they were proud of their heritage. It's like, you know, "Ode to My Family" was done in Dublin in a bar where we served beer freely, and it was a drunken, beautiful experience. That and then, like in the video, like I shot orphans in some tenement in Dublin. you know, it was just so damn Irish. Was,
yeah.
You know, that's all I can, that's what I think of when I think of that stuff. It's just Irish, man, and pain and pathos and I don't know, who's the great Irish poet?
Yeats?
And that's what I thought. But yeah. Back to your question, they loved each other. That's what I saw. I didn't, and I think she had just married her husband.
That's right.
Duran Duran. He was like the Duran Duran tour manager or something.
Exactly.
So there was a little bit of a Hollywood sort of different, you know, as an outsider looking into it, what I saw was someone whose life had changed dramatically very quickly. And her relationship with the band was much more like, these are my brothers, these are my, this is my family. And maybe not to delve too deeply into whatever her relationship was with her husband or anything like that, but that seemed like more of a, like a Hollywood sort of thing in a way. I don't know.
Well, that's interesting. Maybe, I mean, in our cover story at the time, it was kind of expressed that she was the only one who had a kind of entourage about her, which included the husband, and there was a little bit of a separation there once that marriage happened. So I think that's maybe what you're hinting at.
Yeah, and you know, and he was protective over her, and it was maybe, you know, again, not trying to delve too deeply into it, but like maybe if there was friction or division within the band, it's easy to look at like the rock star cliche. I've certainly lived it and seen it. Perhaps there was some conflict there that I didn't see, but I generally got the sense that we listen to what Dolores says and she writes the music and we make hits and we make money and let's keep it going.
What was her relationship to the spotlight and to the idea of making an image for herself and all of that? Because as these videos were a large part of what formed people's impression of her as an icon. So what was on her mind with that?
You know, I don't know because I wasn't in her head, but I can say that as an image maker, you know, look, I was always looking at whether it was fractured beauty or someone like Kurt that didn't want to be beautiful, or you meet somebody and you're like, you know, and I'm a photographer, I'm like, wow, you photograph amazing. And when I shot the video, she had bleached blonde hair and it was almost like a Madonna thing going on. And from spending time with her, I found some sort of a vibe of like there was something just fragile about her. That's all I can really say, if that makes sense.
She's somewhere in there, by her own account, she actually had a serious breakdown somewhere in the 94, 95 area. Did you ever see any signs of this as someone who had a real psychological fragility about her? Did you get close enough to see any of that?
A little bit. I mean, you know, I just didn't look at them that way. Looked at them as like the small band from Limerick, Ireland that got thrusted into the spotlight and seemed to be handling it pretty well. That's sort of what I didn't know anything about the breakdown or anything like that. I do know that, you know, we did have a falling out in the end. I did four videos for them. It was one of the videos I had, I cast the guy from Lord of the Rings.
Elijah Wood.
Elijah Wood. So I cast him in a video and I did this really beautiful thing where I shot them instead of freak show posters and put her in a red dress. And it was my fourth video. We built a gold microphone and all this stuff, and she hated it. So if there's any, you know, it didn't happen to me very often, but like we had to completely recut the video and we put a bunch of live performance in there. We sort of had a falling out. You know, I wasn't happy about it. But so when you asked me about problems or whatever, the breakdown, that was 95. So yeah. Maybe she didn't like looking at herself the way she looked in the video, if I have to think too much about it.
Did you ever talk to her after that?
No, and I feel pretty bad, actually. I think that they reached out a few years ago to do a video, and I'm not sure we responded.
Before we move on, I wanted to ask about the color palette. You know, in Zombie, the scene with the cross, when we look at that now, it screams 90s. I don't know if you have the same reaction. What do you remember about just kind of what the influences were that built up to that look that we now think of as, oh my God, that is a 90s video music video, that is the only thing it can be, if you know what I mean?
Right. Listen, everybody had their shtick back in the day. And I guess it's not really a shtick. I had a look and a style and a feeling. And I think that, in all honesty, like I was trying, you know, I had this black and white footage. I need to have something with the performance was just as, you know, think about it. creatively. It's like it's just like writing a song. It's like, you know, is the verse and the chorus and the hooks going to take you through a song? So I've got all this documentary footage of soldiers in Belfast and children with guns. What can I shoot that will be as striking or as powerful or as emotional as that stuff? It's not going to be her on a, you know, it's not going to be the sexy, slick performance of them shooting, performing. It has to be something emotional and cathartic. And I thought of Joan of Arc, and I thought of crucifixion, and, you know, this Irish thing, the religious influences, the idea of a cross and sacrifice.
And she was a very devout Catholic, so it's perfect. Yeah.
I think that's what it was. Just something very raw and powerful. That's what it always came to. The music was powerful. I wanted imagery. And it comes to the colors, like gold paint, like a statue, children painted in silver, like statues. The color red looked really powerful next to the black and white photography. So it was a very deliberate thing.
While we have you in the last few minutes of the show, among the many, many music videos and other things you've directed are Nirvana Smells Like Teen Spirit, which is one of the most important visual moments of the 90s across any medium, whether it's TV or movies or anything. And you were fairly inexperienced at this point. You think that Kurt picked you because you had sort of a very, perhaps unintentionally, punk rock reel. Is that accurate?
I think that's a nice way of saying it. I think Kurt picked me because my reel sucked. and maybe there's a punk rock attitude about that. You know, it's funny. Who knew? I mean, I didn't know. I had a friend that worked at Geffen Records, and it was the first video I ever directed, and I begged for a job, and they sent me the advanced music, and I still have that cassette someplace that has Come As You Are, Smells Like Teen Spirit, and another track on it, this battered cassette that is like the catalyst of everything that happened to me in my career and everything, and then I got invited to see them play at the Whiskey, and I saw them play. I walked in as they were playing Smells Like Teen Spirit in front of like a few hundred people, and I'm like, that's the video. And I saw moshing and fury and everything else. And just really quickly, the story, because I've told it lots of times, I'll tell this very quickly, is that, it was my first big break. I think the budget was $30,000, maybe $25,000. Not a lot of money to do a video. And this was the age of Guns N' Roses and Dolphins and CG Dolphins or freaking, and Michael Jackson, MC Hammer. Like, that's what was on MTV. And so nobody thought that the video was going to go anywhere or this was going to do anything. But I'm like, I'm going to make the greatest video I possibly can. And I got the janitor for my apartment complex, and the cheerleaders were strippers that I found. And the... I brought in a pyro guy to do fire, and, you know, I tried to build something really beautiful. And then we invited all these kids from the Whiskey, and we put flyers around Los Angeles to come down to the set and see them play. Anyways, Kurt hated everything. the cheerleaders were too pretty. The set, I think the set looked like an aspirin commercial. It wasn't punk to be on set for 12 hours making a music video. The kids were drinking and didn't want to be there. And I'm fighting to make the greatest music video of all time. You know, and he wouldn't perform the song. And so there's some amazing stuff. A friend of mine just did this documentary on, Montage of Heck.
Right. And, it was great. Yeah.
Yeah. And we had lunch, and he's like, you know, can you talk to Geffen? I'm going to look at the footage. Can you tell me anything about the video? And I think he was shocked when he saw the footage, because there's not a lot of Kurt singing. You know, Kurt would not sing the song. He would like light a cigarette off the flame bar. He would just stand there, not right, performing the right chords. And he really didn't like me. And I finally, and it was terrifying, and it made me angry and everything else. We didn't like each other. And I finally went up to a big record executive, and it was in my 20s, and went up to a big executive and said, listen, you can have the greatest music video of all time or no video. You just got to tell Kurt to perform the song a couple times. And he sang the song with this venom and this anger. He only did it a few takes, and it was amazing. And I got to give him credit. Even at the end, I said, please don't put your face within a foot of the camera because I can't get focus. And so at the end of the video, when he's laughing, that's him fucking with me. Like, put his face in the camera. So after all that, I'm like, great, we have a video. And someone came up to me, the AD, said, you know, the kids who hated me too and had been there all day and were drunk said they want to destroy the set. I'm like, I looked around. I'm like, what can they destroy? They can destroy the drums and the guitar, and it's not my stuff. Some of it was my stuff. And I'm like, fine, destroy it. What do I care? And the kids and Kurt started thrashing the set. And I'm looking at it, and it's lit beautifully. I'm like, oh, man, that's really amazing. And do we have a full mag of film in the camera? And like, yeah, we got 400 feet. I put it in slow motion. I shot it. That was the end of the video.
Incredible. And Sam Bayer, in the couple minutes we have left, maybe you can deliver the one-minute version of the origin of the B-Girl, because incredibly, you also directed the No Rain video.
Okay, one-minute version, B-Girl. I saw the album cover. I saw this girl on the cover. And I think a girlfriend of mine at the time, I wrote a bunch of ideas, and I think we talked about, I said, what if the B-Girl came to life? What if we told a story about a fairy tale where this kid's laughed at school, runs kind of like alternative methodology, you know, what alternative music was.
Yeah.
The Outsiders taking over. So, and she runs through Los Angeles, and she comes to an open field and finds people like her. So it was a metaphor, if you will, for what alternative music was, and was really pretty. How was that? That was 30 seconds.
Incredible. Sam Bayer, it's, you know, thank you so much for talking with us. It's truly amazing to consider how much of what we think of as the 90s, our memories of the 90s, you shaped as a music video director. So really appreciate it.
My pleasure, and thanks, guys.
Absolutely. So this has been Rolling Stone Music Now. We were talking about the life and music of Dolores O'Riordan, and we'll be back next week at 1 p.m. here on SiriusXM's Volume, channel 106. In the meantime, download us as a podcast, subscribe to us as a podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, and maybe leave us a nice review. We could use it. And in the meantime, we will be back next week, and we'll see you then.
Welcome to Talkville, the ultimate Smallville rewatch podcast. Guest star Sarah Carter as Alicia Baker. Although I didn't really work with her a lot. But Tom did, and they had some real big smoochy scenes.
Yeah. Should we talk about that?
Could there be any more sex? What was a three-page makeout scene that just kept going? Good Lord. We get it. They have chemistry.
Jump in now or catch up on any of the past seasons of Talkville on YouTube or wherever you listen.